Good morning, all.
Good morning, Your Honor.
The first case for argument this morning, Philips Electronics versus Advent America. Mr. Frenchman.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Ken Frenchman. I represent Philips Electronics North America Corporation, who's actually the successor in interest to Advent America Incorporated. I refer to them in the briefs as PNAC, and I'll refer to them this morning as PNAC. PNAC appeals the decision of the district court denying PNAC's claim that the insurers have an obligation to defend it in over a dozen class action lawsuits, wherein plaintiffs allege that PNAC's products, which are primarily baby bottles and sippy cups, contain the chemical, the allegedly hazardous chemical BPA, which the plaintiffs in that action allege causes a numerous amount of health risks and a danger to the people. In these suits, plaintiffs claim that PNAC failed to warn the purchasers of the products that they contain BPA, and that BPA causes a litany of health problems. In ruling that the insurers have no duty to defend against the BPA actions, the district court made several errors of law that warrant reversal of the district court's decision.
All right. So, Mr. Frenchman, I wanted to call to your attention a statement in the consolidated case before the Western District of Missouri. It's actually in the introductory paragraph where the plaintiffs are speaking here, and it says, defendants correctly note that plaintiffs do not seek to recover for personal injuries or property damage. So why isn't that something that dictates the scope of the duty to defend here?
Two reasons, Your Honor. First of all, that's a different context. They're talking about different things. In that case, they're talking generally about medical expenses, pain and suffering, those sorts of individualized damages. The underlying BPA actions don't seek those damages. We don't dispute that.
I mean, they're kind of, I thought they were essentially contract actions where there was an allegation that the products were described as having certain characteristics, and in fact, they don't have those characteristics. They're not safe for little children, et cetera. And so people are essentially saying, I want my money back. I bought a bum product.
I would disagree with that characterization. I think what the underlying suits are, and you don't need to go further than the first sentence of the first substantive paragraph of the underlying complaint, it says, this action arises out of defendants' misrepresentations and or omissions and failures to warn of and or otherwise disclose or adequately disclose that their baby products are manufactured using a dangerous chemical recognized to be toxic in several respects for years and which poses serious risks to individuals' health as the fact that it leaches into food and beverages in the course of normal everyday use. That does not sound to me like a contract action.
Well, do any of the plaintiffs say they got hurt?
The plaintiffs allege that this product causes injuries.
Do any of them say they were injured in such a way?
They do not specifically allege at this point in time that they were injured. They do, however, seek damages, a litany of damages that go well beyond I want my money back.
But it couldn't be personal injury damages if they don't say they're hurt.
It couldn't be medical expenses. It couldn't be pain and suffering. It could be damages because of bodily injury. And damages because of bodily injury is what the contract between my client and the insurers requires.
But you mean somebody else's bodily injury, because you just told Judge Hamilton that it's not their own bodily injury. It's more or less third-party standing.
I didn't tell Judge Hamilton that it wasn't their own bodily injury. They don't specifically plead that in the complaint. But what they do say is that this product exposes you to a harmful chemical which causes bodily injury. Courts in Illinois have recognized that bodily injury does not necessarily mean the manifestation of sickness or disease. In Zurich v. Raymark, an asbestos case...
Well, no, but wait a minute. I think we need to nail this down because when you look at this case as a whole, it seems to be about the dangerousness of these products to children. Some of the plaintiffs, I suppose, are mothers. Some of the plaintiffs are fathers. They tend to be parents. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. So you're not alleging at all that any of the mothers, for example, had bodily injury from these products?
I am not alleging anything, and I don't think that the complaints allege that.
Because the line that I read and the one that appears to be the consolidated complaint seems not only not to allege it, but it seems to disclaim any intent to recover for personal injuries or property damage.
In the underlying action, they have definitely, there's no question that they've tailored their claim around getting class certification under Rule 23.
Right, and why can't you hold people to their litigation strategies?
Well, you can hold people to their litigation strategies, but their litigation strategies under Illinois law does not dictate whether or not a claim is covered. It's not the legal labels. As you yourself, Your Honor, I believe were on the panel in Cincinnati Insurance. In Cincinnati Insurance, this court held that, yes, the claim seeks tortious interference. That's what it's about. But this policy covers disparagement and defamation. And defamation and disparagement are covered under this policy, and that's what leads to the tortious interference. This conduct, this court held in that case, is covered. The same is true here. In this case, it's a failure to warn case.
Mr. Frenchman.
Yes.
Are any of the underlying plaintiffs seeking damages for medical monitoring expenses, which is, you know, often an element when you have exposure that hasn't yet manifested itself in an illness?
There is no explicit claim for medical monitoring.
Any hint of it anywhere in the underlying litigation in Kansas City?
There is not a hint of medical monitoring. But what there is in these complaints is a litany of purported damages. They don't just say this action is limited to recovering the price of our baby bottles. That's not what this says. This complaint leaves open every door. It says consequential damages, compensatory damages, equitable relief, general damages. It lays out everything under the sun. And I would submit to you that the only thing that has been limited in the underlying case is, okay, pain and suffering's out. Medical expenses out. You know why? Because our counsel and the counsel for the other defendants put these underlying plaintiffs in a catch-22 situation. They said, you guys don't allege this stuff, do you? And they had a choice. The plaintiffs had a choice. They could say, yes, we do, in which case, there goes their class cert. Or they could say, no, you're right, we don't.
But so your position has been that you are, in fact, making the defense that you think the insurance company should be furnishing.
Absolutely.
So let me ask, I want to come at this at from a slightly different angle. The judicial panel in multi-district litigation consolidates a number of cases in the Western District of Missouri. Presumably, at least in theory, there would come a time when those cases would be returned to the originating districts, right?
Correct.
And at that time, each case once again stands on its own 2 feet. What risk of amendment of claims or what risk of evolution, let's say, of these underlying cases into the kinds of cases that look more suited to the insurance policy is there?
I think there is a risk of that. I think that what they've done, either through amendment or a situation where evidence comes out at trial, what has happened here, this compensatory damages, general damages, consequential damages, they haven't been stricken from this complaint. They are out there. If a plaintiff is someday on the stand talking about certain damages that it has, I can guarantee you that our lawyers, our defense lawyers, will jump up, scream, that's not in the complaint. It's not there. And the plaintiffs will say, what are you talking about? We told you this action seeks consequential damages. We told you this action seeks actual damages, general damages. All this stuff, that's what this plaintiff is testifying to here. That is what gives us the potential for coverage. It's not the – we're not claiming that this case, because it asked for their money back, that that's the hook to coverage. It's not. The hook to coverage is the fact that it goes beyond mere damages for return of the product. It goes into other areas of damages which have not been foreclosed.
And that puts you in an interesting position, because you actually here have to sit here and argue to us that you've got all this exposure under the case, and yet when you put your other hat on, you will be arguing just as vigorously that none of it should be sustained.
And as a matter of law, I would submit to you that we shouldn't be put in a position like that, and that was not the intent of the litigation insurance that we purchased. But going beyond that, I don't even think we're being inconsistent. I am not standing here before you today saying that the plaintiffs are alleging medical expenses, pain and suffering, those types of damages. But what this is, it is a products liability case. Now, I know that the judge in the underlying case says, well, it's not a product liability case because you're not seeking, you know, damages, bodily injury, pain and suffering type damages because you were exposed to the product. But that's not true. Take a step back. There's no definition for product liability claims. PNAC is getting sued. It is getting sued because it distributed and manufactured this product which is alleged to have hurt people.
Well, but it's being sued, but the harm to the people who are now suing, at least the capacity in which they are now suing, is that they spent their money on a bad product, a product that was actually harmful. They're not saying that they were injured. If they turn around and say, now I'm suing in my capacity as guardian of my child, then all of a sudden you can see all of the personal injury claims look like they would be within or easily within the scope of this policy. But that would be a different lawsuit, wouldn't it?
Well, the facts alleged in this lawsuit, the conduct alleged, is that BPA is harmful and it can cause bodily injury. They have brought suit. They have brought suit, failure to warn suits, basically. What we've heard in some of the briefing is that, yeah, but the bodily injury isn't essential to these causes of action. Oh, yes, it is. If there's no bodily injury, if there's no danger, if there's no harm, then there's no failure to warn. Let's face it. What's going to happen here is PNAC, in defending against these suits, their primary defense is we didn't have to warn anyone because these products are safe. They don't cause bodily injury. The plaintiffs, on the other hand, will contend that's wrong. There's all these studies. It shows how harmful this product is. And because of that.
But what about the economic loss doctrine? So the parent buys the sippy cup and gives it to the child and discovers, or at least the parent believes, that this is something that has caused the child to be exposed to a dangerous product. So the parent is going to say, you know, there was a breach of warranty, it's not suitable for the particular purpose that it's designed for, no, you know, warranty of merchantability, you know, you should have warned me that this was a dangerous product, I never would buy anything dangerous for my child. But doesn't the economic loss theory preclude the parent from getting tort damages for that purchase?
And one of the errors that the district court made, in my view, is that it characterized this complaint as only seeking economic losses and only wanting their money back. But nowhere in the complaint does it say, we want our money back for this product and we only want our money back. Instead, what the underlying plaintiffs have done is they've made it a point to keep every possible door open until the defendants can close them as a matter of law.
Well, Mr. Frenchman, is it your position that if you allege in the complaint the consequential damage, all of the litany of damages that you appropriately laid out, that eliminates any speculative nature as to the potential for bodily injury? In other words, by the very fact of praying the damages.
I think it takes more than that. I think that the lawsuit has to seek damages because of that bodily injury. And I would submit that this lawsuit makes allegations of bodily injury, and it seeks damages that is potentially because of that bodily injury. It's not all the damages. It's not everything they seek. But all they need is a sufficient basis for a duty to defend.
And so are the parents saying, for example, that if their child suffers bodily injury, it's the parents who will have to pay the medical bills? Or?
I mean, certainly I think that the cases relied upon by the district court and the insurers all have one common thread, and it's actually a thread that I think you're getting to, and that is standing. I can distinguish every case cited by the insurers and the court because of standing. And what I mean by that is in Crawford, for example, you are dealing with a case where a nonprofit company was suing under statute for failure to warn. Health care industry was a whistleblowing case. There, a nursing home allegedly made fraudulent Medicare claims. Okay? Those were a former employee was making that claim, couldn't sue for bodily injury. HPF, individual brought on behalf of the general public pursuant to a statute that certain issues should have been disclosed. In that case, for example, they never even claimed that the herbal fenfen product was unsafe. They simply didn't make certain required disclosures. ISMIE, again, that's an Illinois case, very recent. It's a whistleblower case. You're talking about two former employees who brought suit because of thousands of allegedly unnecessary surgeries that were charged to Medicare. Again, though there could be bodily injury there, but certainly those former employees could not bring the suit. Diamond State is a suit that the state brought. It involves a suit the state brought because of faulty air conditioner. And in there was a consequential damage claim relating to lost work days, and the policyholders in that case argued that those lost work days were on account of illness, and therefore that's bodily injury. Yeah, but the state couldn't possibly, wasn't even a potential for the state to sue for those actual bodily injuries or because of those bodily injuries. However, this case, I would submit to you, is different because the parents do have standing to sue on behalf of their infants. And I think that the cases cited by the insurers and the court, while distinguishable in many cases for several reasons, such as Crawford, for example, because it uses, in their insuring agreement, says for bodily injury, not because of bodily injury, but even though there are distinguishable aspects of each of those cases, the one common thread is standing. And I think that's very significant here. I see that I'm into my rebuttal, so I will sit down unless you have further questions.
Thank you. Mr. Savino?
Good morning. May it please the Court, my name is William Savino. I'm a member of the firm of Rifkin Radler. With me is my partner, Stephen Smirty. Very briefly, the insurer side of this argument has decided to share its time. I will take 15 minutes of time with the Court's permission, and Mr. Bordes will take 5 minutes of time and will address, among other things, the timing of the occurrence issue.
Let me start you out, though, with a couple of things that concern me about your side of this case. And I begin with the standard that Illinois uses, and I gather we're all comfortable that this is an Illinois law case.
We are.
For deciding about a duty to defend. It's whether facts have been stated that are even potentially within the policy coverage. Obviously, at the end of the day, there might not be a duty to indemnify, but the duty to defend is broad. And one thing that concerns me is the focus on theory, because certainly in federal courts, one is not required to plead legal theories. That's not true even now after Twombly and Iqbal, and it certainly wasn't true at the time of this. the claim is supposed to provide a short and plain statement of the claim, and it's facts. Now, maybe more facts post-Iqbal, but it's basically facts. And so I'm concerned that the district court here was too focused on legal theories and not enough on facts. And I'm secondly concerned about the way we should be thinking about Rule 54C of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure in conjunction with this, because this Rule 54C says, among other things, it's not a default judgment, which this certainly will not be, every other final judgment should grant the relief to which each party is entitled, even if the party has not demanded that relief in its pleadings. So even if the pleadings don't say, for example, we want relief for bodily injury, if at the end of a trial it looks like that's what the party's entitled to, then Rule 54C seems to say that that's what they should get. And finally, I'm concerned about just the multi-district litigation posture. I kind of alluded to that with Mr. Frenchman. The cases are there in Missouri for a certain amount of pretrial coordination, and I certainly recognize that a lot of the time things get settled at that stage. But in theory, each of these cases will once again stand on its own. There could be amendments, there are capacity issues. And so it's very hard for me to say at this moment that the policy coverage is so remote that there should not be a duty to defend.
I have a couple of responses.
All right. I'm sure you do. So I just wanted to put it all on the table, and you can take them.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. I have a couple of responses. And if I recall the order in which you asked me those questions first, and I'd like to
be in a conference with Judge Wooden.
If you invite me to your conference, I'd be happy to attend. I'd be happy to attend. But if I recall, and if we keep on getting distracted, I won't. But here we go. First, the district court got it right. The district court did not do what I think you've suggested. The district court first undertook an analysis of the factual allegations of the underlying complaints. It stepped back and it said, these claims rest, all of these complaints rest on the same factual predicate. The plaintiffs, purchases, not users of these plastic products, but purchases, want their money back. And he spent time examining that. He didn't then just rule. He then examined the relief requested. And he saw that the relief requested essentially, again, in all of those complaints in the multi-district suit, Your Honor, sought disgorgement of profits, actual damages, injunctive relief, punitive damages, never compensatory damages. And
but
then,
that's at a preliminary stage, though, and that's why I mentioned maybe this is now segueing into our second point, the Rule 54C point. They do have these catch-all phrases in the complaints, and we're looking for whatever else we might be able to grab, too, mm-hmm. in essence. And so at the duty-to-defend stage,
yes.
we aren't talking about who's going to win here. We're talking about who undertakes the transaction costs.
True. To finish my response to your first series of
right.
questions,
right.
in addition, the district court made, we believe, the proper conclusion because it did analyze this court's ruling in health care, and it said there must be a direct causal link between the allegations and the relief sought. And the district court made that examination, put itself through that test, and found a complete absence of that causal linkage, number one. Number two, the plaintiffs in the underlying suits in Missouri have repeatedly stated, not by whim, but by design, they have repeatedly and affirmatively stated, we do not seek damages because of bodily injury. Oh, and
but
interesting.
That's the sentence that I read.
And interestingly enough, so did PNOC. PNOC said in its motion practice in the underlying suits, please allow me to quote, instead, plaintiffs allege BPA has the risk, not manifested, in fact, in any harm, of opening a Pandora's box of serious and irreversible health effects. Event stated, contrary to what it said at this podium, but in the underlying suits, it said no plaintiff seeks bodily injury, no plaintiff seeks damages because of bodily injury, no plaintiff was ever even exposed to levels of BPA that is harmful, and the plaintiffs then agreed, and what did they do? That slams the door shut with respect to our obligation, potential obligation to defend. The plaintiffs have fully confined the claim to one that is outside coverage.
Well,
and finally, if I may, okay, to answer your last question, even though they may have said, we seek reimbursement, we want our money back because they defrauded us, they do say, I must acknowledge, we want such other and further relief as may be just. However, Illinois law, case after case after case, has stated, and we've cited them in our submissions, that that is simply not enough to trigger the duty to defend. Finally, this court has said in Hearst versus Commercial Union, that true, just as Your Honor has stated, the duty to defend is triggered if there's the mere possibility that the facts may bring it into coverage. But how we determine what is a mere possibility, this court said, must be governed by common sense and good reason. And in fact, a plaintiff's insured's interpretation of the alleged wrongdoing in the underlying suits should not compel the insurer to abide by those interpretations if they are far-fetched or unreasonable. Well, isn't it far-fetched and unreasonable when every single litigant in the underlying suit, every one of them, including Event, has stated these suits do not involve claims for bodily injury? Your Honor, they've done our job.
Let me ask you this then. You should be very happy to make this concession based on what you've just said. Suppose the parents, the exact parents that we're dealing with right now, bring a second lawsuit, different docket number, they file separately, on behalf of their children for bodily injury, just like the suit out in California.
Yes.
You would concede, I take it, that that suit would not be either claim or issue precluded based on this case, that it is not part of the same case or controversy in the constitutional sense.
I think the point that Your Honor makes is dramatically, in my view, compels the conclusions that we seek here in affirmance of the trial court's decision. Because guess what our clients did do in the California case when bodily injury was alleged?
I am concerned about the following scenario. Here's this lawsuit pending right now. Some of the underlying cases even go so far as to allege that injury in utero was inflicted on the developing child, and that tends to suggest to me it's probably not so healthy for the mother either, and I'm concerned that if these cases get sent back to the originating courts, an amendment to the complaint would be very easy, saying, you know, normally speaking, claim splitting rules would not allow you to sue for your contract damages in case number one and your tort damages in case number two. You would be claim precluded. You agree with that?
Your Honor, yeah. Those would be, my light is on, but those facts would be distinct from the facts of this case where the claim has been confined to no injury, no bodily injury cases. That case, if bodily injury was alleged, and assuming that all other conditions of the policy have been met, well, then that presents a different factual scenario. And our decision here, your decision here, we hope affirming the trial court's decision, would be without effect on that new and different set of facts.
But under Rule 15, it would be within the discretion of the trial judge to allow an amendment. It's not, I mean, you're arguing actually for a very strong version of waiver here, as I hear you.
Well, I want to answer your question, I think that you posed. If there is an amendment a year or 2 years from now, and that amendment somehow is tendered to the insurers and the facts are different, then perhaps a duty to defend would commence at that point. But there isn't one here. May I make one other point? I know my time will be up in response to your question with the court's permission. I find that as a matter of interest, the following scenario that I think compels our point. When Event comes to the podium, they say, those suits are replete with allegations of bodily injury. Yet today, and in the underlying suit, Event has stated, and we believe they are judicially estopped here today to argue, as they have, that there are claims for bodily injury, because in the underlying suit, they've said just the opposite. So let me pose this.
The Broadway suit? Or which?
The Broadway suit and virtually every other one of the suits are no injury class action suits.
Their response to that is it's not over yet. Mr. Savino, perhaps you or Mr. Borders, I'll let you figure out how to decide this, but I'd be very curious about your thoughts about the Fourth Circuit's decision in Northern Insurance. And if we were to agree with you, how you would suggest dealing with that case, apart from just saying it's not published? Other than just saying it's not published.
I am not familiar with the facts of that case, Your Honor.
That was the cell phone headset case?
I am, by another name, the Audiovox case. Yes. Okay. Those cases, Your Honor, merely set forth relevant background information. And courts have said, well, in the gun litigation, in the cell phone and ear set cases, those courts have said, well, we see that there are allegations of bodily injury. But again, using the test that is required here, they are merely relevant items of relevant background and will not dictate a duty to defend. They are offered only for reference purposes. I might add, no different than what has been presented in the underlying suits, that those statements that BPA potentially could be harmful do not give rise, are not sufficient to trigger the duty to defend. They are merely, if you will, setting the stage.
Thank you, Mr. Spann.
Thank you.
Mr. Borders?
May it please the court, counsel. Michael Borders on behalf of State Farm. In response to Justice Wood's question, an affirmance of the district court's opinion.
Hoping for that. I don't want you jinxing. So we'll be judged for today.
An affirmation of Judge Leinenweber's declaratory judgment would not preclude the possibility that if a claim is later brought on behalf of a minor child claiming bodily injury from BPA, that claim could not be tendered to a carrier who may have coverage at the time that bodily injury was sustained.
But these very plaintiffs, I mean, what I'm concerned about is a game of bait and switch, basically, that here you're saying, oh, there's no coverage because there's no bodily injury, and then at some point they amend the complaint or one of the mothers, you know, indicates that she was also injured, and you say, oh, you know, too bad, you were too late, you should have included it all in the first suit.
This, in my view, this court's opinion affirming the trial court's judgment would not be res judicata on that issue.
Okay.
The district courts, my comments are really now focusing on the necessity of an occurrence and the date of occurrence issue, which is unique to State Farm in Pennsylvania. But it's important to remember that it's not only enough that there be an allegation of bodily injury, but that the bodily injury be caused by an occurrence. All right. Now, in this case, if you look at the underlying class action, it's by purchasers. And they're saying it may potentially in the future cause bodily injury. Well, until it does, or there's an allegation that it has, there has been no occurrence. So this is all consistent with the scope of coverage granted by a CGL policy.
We want this to turn on the fact that the parents purchase this rather than infants making a purchase.
No, it's not that. But the fact is, until there is bodily injury alleged, until it occurs, until someone sustains bodily injury, there is no occurrence. The policies don't cover the manufacture of a defective product. It's when the defective product causes an accident resulting in bodily injury that coverage is triggered.
Even if it's a long tail sort of thing like asbestos or coal dust or whatever?
The same, because in asbestos they claim bodily injury is a triple trigger, that you're injured as soon as you inhale asbestos, which is different from other injuries. So you sustain an injury when you inhale the fibers. Right? In BPA, they're just saying there's this potential for harm. We're not seeking recovery for it.
More like lead, I guess. Huh?
It's similar to lead. Yeah. Lead can be in your system and not cause bodily injury until it reaches a certain critical level.
Right.
So the the bottom line is that a CGL carrier is not a guarantor of its insured's products. It does not agree to defend any claim or suit brought against its insured where the integrity of its product is challenged. All right. It only agrees to defend the insured when a claim is brought, in this context, for bodily injury caused by an occurrence during the policy period that the carrier has coverage in effect. Now, State Farm, an argument that Judge Lineweber didn't have to rule on, was the date of occurrence issue. And State Farm's last policy was 10 years before the first class action complaint was filed. So our policy expired on April 11, 1997. And the fact of the matter is that even if you assume there's the potential for bodily injury, there's no allegation of fact in any of these complaints that would potentially say that someone is seeking to recover damages for bodily injury sustained more than 10 years prior to the filing of this complaint. And even though the master complaint in Broadway doesn't, as it did in the predecessor complaint, define the class to be only those who purchased the products within the last 5 years, of the 8 causes of action pled in the Broadway master complaint, the longest statute of limitations is 5 years. So at best, they could get back to 1997.
Now, your opponents have said is great.
2002.
Right. As I understand Mr. Frenchman's argument, he says all of the things you say may be great, but that's what the defense looks like. You know, that the case has been brought against his clients, and somebody has to stand up and make precisely the defense that you're talking about vis-a-vis the untimeliness of these complaints. And in his view, of course, it's you who ought to be making you the various insurance companies for the various periods.
His point would have validity if there was a complaint pled that alleged that there was bodily injury that was sustained prior to a statute running. So let's say, for example, a plaintiff said, I was injured in 1997. State Farm would have a duty to defend that claim and come in and assert the statute of limitations defense. Right? But in this case, where there is no claim pled for injury that backdates into that policy, all we're looking to the statute of limitations for is to look at what are the parameters of the claims pled, and do any of these plaintiffs, based upon any of the theories or facts pled, seek damages potentially going back as far as 1997, or in Pennsylvania's case, 2001? And the answer is no.
Thank you, supporters. Ms. Frenchman?
Thank you. Apparently, I've blown a good portion of my rebuttal time, but I will be short, and I just want to focus on a few points. One, the comment was made that BPA is similar to lead. It's exactly right. That's exactly what we argue in our case. And if you look at a lead paint case in the District Court of Illinois, RC2, you will see that that case holds that it's recognized under Illinois law that exposure to potentially harmful contaminants constitutes bodily injury even without manifestation of sickness or disease.
Well, that takes us to, in a sense, the waiver argument that Mr. Savino is making, as I understand him, that, you know, you're between Scylla and Charybdis, right? You know, on the one hand, you would have coverage but no class action that you were facing. On the other hand, there's no coverage but there is a great class action over in the contract side. And I guess he's arguing that plaintiffs so thoroughly waived their personal injury claims that you're left with no coverage.
He is arguing that, but I would argue not so thoroughly. I mean, yes, the defendants
There's that, and then if we assume that you're right about the duty to defend, it's the breach of contract that puts you in that trap, and that's not fair, right?
Right.
Okay.
Right. And I would encourage you to, always assume that.
Keep thinking that way, right? I'm still thinking.
I do think that it's not only about amendment of the complaint, although I agree with you, and that is similar to what the Northern District of California held in Plantronics, a Bluetooth headset case. But beyond that, there are allegations in this case that maybe they're vague, maybe they're frivolous, but they are seeking things like, you know, Mr. Savino says it doesn't say compensatory damages. Sure it does. It has a litany of damages in the complaint: compensatory, general, actual, equitable relief, which according to Outboard Marine, the Illinois Supreme Court says equitable relief is damages under a CGL policy, where damages is an undefined term like it is here. The other thing I will respond to briefly with regard to the claims that go back a ways and the policies that go back a way, well, you know, they might be right again about the statute of limitations. And we may very well press some of these claims if they allege exposure that goes back beyond 10 years. But that just makes it a frivolous claim. Frivolous claims, they are obligated to defend groundless, false, fraudulent claims. I think my time is up, so unless you have questions, I thank you.
Apparently not. Thank you, Mr. Frenchman. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.